You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
If you're confused about what foods will make you healthiest, you may be surprised to learn from Michael Pollan that nutritionists are also largely in the dark. But the acclaimed food writer has some ideas of his own, and his latest book, Food Rules, an Eater's Manual, which is published by Penguin, is a slim volume containing 64 eating guidelines that conform to Mr. Pollan's imperative, eat food, mostly plants, not too much. I'm sure you're aware of The Omnivore's Dilemma, his groundbreaking work, which spent 117 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list and was given the James Beard Award in 2007, and was one of the number of books that we have talked about with him. I'm pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hi.
Hi. Good to be back, Leonard.
In this new manual, you argue that folklore can guide us to healthier eating habits than scientists can. Are you suggesting that nutrition research is something of a waste of time?
No. I'm suggesting nutrition science is a very, let's put it charitably, a young science, that they've only been at it for less than 200 years, since about 1840. And they
Wait. We've had Newton, Darwin, Einstein. That's a we've learned all about the double helix, DNA, RNA, et cetera, mm-hmm. in those 200 years, and we can't figure out which foods are good for us?
No, because food is more complicated than a lot of those things. Well, on both sides of the food chain, you've got human digestion, which is an incredibly complex process. We thought it was just kind of simple breakdown of complex molecules into simpler ones, but it's not. I mean, you've got as many neurons in your digestive tract as you have in your spine. What are they doing there? What are they thinking? We don't know. And then on the other side, you have something like a carrot, which turns out to be unimaginably complex. And every time we try to reduce it to what we think is the good thing, the key ingredient, beta carotene, it turns out to slip away from us. And there are 49 other carotenes. And so there's a wilderness still at both ends of the food chain. Science has made progress without question. But after 2 or 3 years spent looking at nutrition science as a journalist, I've just been amazed at how little they still know and how imperfect their tools are for studying it. And that, you know, so I went looking for another source of wisdom. Not to discard that, but to complement that. And that, of course, is culture. Long before science told us what to do about our bodies, people had cultures. And cultures have culture is really the distilled wisdom of the group. Lots of trial and error over lots of time, figuring out what to eat and what keeps people healthy. And there's still a lot of wisdom there. And I wanted to give kind of equal time to that wisdom in this book.
And those traditional cultures have developed their diets based on what was available near them. So they're quite different throughout the world.
Well, and that's one of the really striking things about it. You know, there are always experts telling us we should eat this way, we shouldn't eat that way, we should eat meat, or we should eat vegetables only, or we should...
No carbs.
Yeah, but you go around the world and you find traditional cultures, before they've been kind of contaminated with Western eating habits, eating an incredible range of different foods. I mean, you've got the Inuit subsisting on seal blubber. So what does that tell us about fat? Well, maybe it's not so bad.
Are you suggesting that we might live on seal blubber, 75% fat?
Yeah.
In the Inuit diet.
Well, I don't think we can, and I think we want to leave the seals alone. They eat all that seal blubber, and they have no type 2 diabetes, virtually no heart disease. And, they're very healthy. And then you've got Maasai warriors who subsist on a very high protein diet of cattle blood and meat and a little bit of milk. They're some of the healthiest people on the planet. And then you've got Central American Indians who, you know, eat corn and beans by and large, a very high carbohydrate diet, also very healthy. What that tells you is there is no one ideal human diet. And that we are, the wonderful thing about being the omnivores we are is we can adapt to whatever nature offers us wherever we happen to live.
Are there some food cultures that you think are more suitable to contemporary Western life than others?
Well, the Inuit is certainly less so.
The old French court where everything was butter?
Yeah, well, you know, we're learning, as it turns out, that the scientists were wrong about that one too, weren't they? They told us margarine was better for us than butter for a long time, and they worked very hard to get us off of butter. And it turns out they put us on trans fats, and that turned out not to work out very well for us and our hearts. They've gotten it wrong repeatedly, and that's fine. That's how science works, and they'll get it right eventually. But as I put it in the book, you know, nutrition science is kind of where surgery was in the year 1650. they've got a ways to go.
Well, a lot of Americans wind up mixing their cultures.
You have sushi. That's right.
Then you eat French food. Then you eat Indian food, Chinese food. We're not sticking to one culture. Does that make our diet more unbalanced?
I don't know what the effect is, and no one's really looked at that question of if you mix your Mediterranean diet with your Asian diet. But all of these diets have some very, you know, valuable things to teach us. And the way they combine foods turns out to have a scientific logic when we look at it. You know, I mean, the story you always hear is wasabi with raw fish, and the wasabi is an antibiotic and probably protects you from getting sick as you might eating that. Or eating tomatoes with olive oil, you know, which, you know, grandmothers have known for a long time is a really good way to handle tomatoes. And scientists recently figured out that the olive oil, the oil in the makes the lycopene more accessible to your body. And so science is sometimes catching up with folk wisdom on food.
A listener in London left a question for you on our show page. Can you comment on the recent UK study that claimed that organic foods have no discernible health benefits over ordinary foods?
Yeah, I read that study, and there's a lot of reaction to it, and pointing out that it didn't avail itself of some recent research. There's a lot of very good research on this question that's been done at University of California, Davis, that did find measurable differences in the nutrient density of organic food and foods generally grown in healthy, non-chemically treated soils. So it was the critique on the part of people who answered the study was that it was incomplete and it overlooked a lot of important studies. But I don't know that the reason to eat organic food is that it's nutritionally superior, and that was never the argument made. The argument was that this was better for the environment and better to keep pesticides out of the food supply and out of your children's brains. And that all, you know, whether the food is measurable, whether it matters that an organic apple has 30% more zinc than a conventional apple, are you really not getting enough zinc? You know, it may not really matter. But the bigger point is treating the soil better and not exposing the workers to so much pesticide. The best reasons to eat organic are environmental.
And by the way, it's something that adheres to one of your rules, which is we're going back to the old ways, the ways that worked quite well for a long, long time.
Yeah, although I kind of resist the characterization of organic as turning back the clock, because the organic farmers I've visited with and watched are doing something that we haven't done before. And organic food is not just the absence of pesticides. It usually involves a very sophisticated knowledge of soil science and entomology and crop rotations that probably didn't exist before. So I sort of see it as a post-industrial rather than a pre-industrial way of doing things, and that it does definitely borrow a lot of a peasant and traditional wisdom, but combines it in ways that I don't think we've seen before.
Michael Pollan's latest book is called Food Rules, an Eater's Manual. It's published by Penguin, and it has pretty much one rule per page. But it's more than 64 pages. You have compiled 64 rules here, divided into three categories. Eat food, mostly plants, and not too much. So this is a follow-up to
In Defense of Food. It is. And indeed, one of the reasons I wrote it is that a lot of doctors, actually, in particular, were saying to me after In Defense of Food, which is a kind of more extensive polemic about nutrition science and the food industry and how we're really deceived into thinking that we're eating health food when we're not with a lot of processed foods. Doctors were saying, you know, I really need a pamphlet I can give my patients, something really simple, memorable rules, no science, no history, just pare it down. And that's what that was the inspiration for this book.
Well, when you visited our show last May, we invited listeners to write in their own food rules. Did any of them
make it actually
into this book?
I used some of the rules I got on this show and some of the rules I did on the blog, some of my favorite rules. I don't remember if it came from this show, but one that a reader sent in or a listener sent in was don't buy cereals that change the color of the milk, which I thought was such an elegant way to get away from chemically treated cereal. And another one that I got from listeners or readers was, and this came from both a Jewish and an Italian grandmother, the whiter the bread, the sooner you'll be dead. I love for its bluntness. It's very harsh, but it turns out there's a lot of science to back it up. I mean, white flour is not very good for you.
The first section of Food Rules is called Eat Food. Do we eat things that aren't food?
Yeah, that's the hard part. You know, it sounds very simple. What should you eat? You should eat food. But there's a lot of what I call edible food-like substances now in the supermarket masquerading as food. And so the whole first section of this book is a series of rules or algorithms that will help you distinguish the real food from this other stuff. And this other stuff is really the novel creations of food science over the last 50 or 75 years. And
so rule two says don't eat anything that our grandmothers or great-grandmothers wouldn't recognize as food. That suggests that Americans ate better during the Great Depression.
Well, they often did. And in fact, you know, rates of, if you look at rates of chronic disease, they were better then. They were much better during the war, too.
But hasn't life expectancy gone up?
Yeah, life expectancy has gone up since the beginning of the century. But most of the gain, it's gone up about 17 years, and 11 of those years are attributed to a surviving childhood, essentially, improved rates of infant mortality and childhood health and inoculations and things like that. And then we've added 6 years at the end of life through our heroic interventions on heart disease and cancer and things like that. It is not a superior diet that accounts for our longer life. To the contrary, the American diet is responsible for about three-quarters of the healthcare spending. I mean, we spend it on chronic diseases linked to diet. That is, the healthcare crisis is a euphemism for the catastrophe of the American diet.
And obesity is cited as a major problem in this country.
Yeah, obesity accounts for $1 in $10 spent on healthcare. It's a miracle to me that we haven't talked more about food and the American diet during this healthcare debate. And we talk about the perverse incentives in the system and overtreatment, but pull back a little and you realize, what are they overtreating? They're overtreating chronic diseases linked to diet.
Many people who support the expanded use of organic food point out that there are all sorts of a lot of money goes to people who make the other kind of food, and perhaps
you're talking about government money.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because this is all about government spending, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, the subsidy system, the way we support agriculture in this country, and we spend tens of billions of dollars supporting agriculture in this country, is all geared toward getting farmers to produce cheap commodity crops like corn and soy. And these are the building blocks of the worst food in the marketplace. We are subsidizing high fructose corn syrup. We're subsidizing hydrogenated soy oil, all the calories that we shouldn't be eating. And we're doing very little for people growing real food.
But getting back to rule two, an American great-grandmother might not recognize a guava or even olive oil
and that's
food, depending on her background. So how should we interpret that, Ray?
Well, what I say actually is if your grandmother was a lousy cook or had ate really badly, you can, for imaginative purposes, adopt a Sicilian grandmother or a Greek grandmother or anybody you like or a Japanese grandmother. The point is really just perform that imaginative exercise when you're picking up that tube of Go-Gurt or that, Twinkie. Would a grandmother or a great-grandmother recognize this as food? We're better off with the foods, which is to say the species of plants, animals, and fungi that have been familiar for many years.
Well, I remember Twinkies and Devil Dogs coming along in the 40s. So that means that's when the change really occurred after World War II?
Most of the changes, there's a couple different waves of change. I think the beginning of the so-called Western diet that began the epidemic of chronic diseases, you can trace to 1875 or so, when you start getting refined white flour and free sugars, sugar in its pure form.
And then we invent things like Crisco,
which
comes out of just taking care of stuff that we had an overabundance of, and so we came up with this new kind of shortening.
Yeah, it was the grain growers who had too much oil, basically vegetable oils, and they figured out a way to make imitation butter, and it was called imitation butter for a long time. And in fact, before the turn of the last century, there were laws in 13 states that you had to dye your margarine purple, so people wouldn't be confused and think that they were getting real butter. I think we should go back to that.
When it first came out, margarine was white, and then there was this little capsule you mixed it in and made it look like butter. Michael Pollan's latest book is called Food Rules, an Eater's Manual. It's published by Penguin. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Michael Pollan, author of a number of best-selling books, five previous books, including In Defense of Food, The Omnivore's Dilemma, and The Botany of Desire, all New York Times bestsellers. The latest is Food Rules, an Eater's Manual. It's published by Penguin. You were talking about the ubiquity of corn and soy in our diet, often hard to even recognize when we look at the ingredients.
Yeah, well, the ingredients don't specify. I mean, sometimes they do, soy lecithin and things like that, and high fructose corn syrup. But so many of the other ingredients, from the ascorbic acid to the xanthan gum to the hydrolyzed vegetable protein, these are products of soy and corn, and these are really the base of our real food pyramid. And the problem is that these ingredients are so cheap, and they so lend themselves to overprocessing of food that we're eating too much of the wrong kind of calories. And that is the result, make no mistake, of policies. And we're not going to, as much as this book is about what you can do without waiting for the government to change things, but we need to make the government change the food system. And the way to do that is through things like the Farm Bill and the Child Nutrition Act, which is coming up very soon, actually.
Well, the Atkins diet suggested that we don't eat any carbohydrates, which would eliminate corn and soy.
Yeah.
But then don't the cows that we eat on the Atkins diet eat all that corn and soy?
They're eating the corn and soy for you. Yeah, so you're still getting corn and soy passed through the body of a cow, which is exactly what they should not be eating.
What about wheat? Does that bother you as well? Because our grandmothers ate a lot of bread.
Yeah, they did. And bread is good food. And, whole grain bread is better for you than white bread, as that rule I mentioned earlier suggests. Wheat is not used in quite as many different disguises as corn and soy, but it's an issue, too. I mean, we overproduce wheat the way we overproduce these other things. And, we only subsidize five crops, and we need to be eating a lot more than that.
Rule 11 says we should avoid foods that are advertised on television.
Yeah, I'll tell you how I came up with that rule. Like other critics of the food industry, I've had these handy mnemonics, like don't buy foods with more than five ingredients or avoid foods with high fructose corn syrup. The food industry, however, is so clever, so much smarter than I am, that they instantly come up with new ways to get around these rules. So take Häagen-Dazs has a new line of ice cream called Five that boasts about the fact it only has the magic five ingredients. And now you've got hundreds of new foods that have been reformulated with real sugar, as if that's a health food.
Pepsi recently
announced
Pepsi a return
to
limited time only.
Yeah. And Coke is doing it, too, in certain markets, and Snapple took the high
fructose corn. It does taste better, by the way.
Well, a lot of people feel that way. I have to say, though, I participated in a blind taste test, and I failed, and I picked the high fructose corn syrup. I'm embarrassed to say, but so that's what you're used to or what we've gotten used to. Many people swear by real sugar in Coke and that it was fizzier and had a kind of
I remember being in Mexico and having a Coke and saying, oh, gee, this reminds me of my childhood.
Yeah, I know.
And not knowing what that all meant until I discovered that there was sugar in it.
Well, Coca-Cola tastes particularly good in Mexico, I think.
But what about sugar? When they talk about cane, that's another thing that gets promoted.
Yeah, you real look at cane sugar.
A jar of
jam.
It's
like a vegetable. Yeah. Well, look, I mean, there, as far as we know, there's no scientific distinction, or your body makes no distinction between getting sugar from corn and getting sugar from cane. All right, high fructose corn syrup is about 50-50 glucose and fructose, and that's what cane sugar is. The problem with high fructose corn syrup, and the reason it's worth avoiding, is that we're getting too much of it, and it's showing up in products that were never sweetened before. Things like bread, things like frozen foods, they put it in everything because unlike sugar, you can put it in everything, and it actually has some positive properties for packaged foods. But that critique has been turned into an implicit health claim for sugar, and that's really dangerous. When people are advertising real cane sugar, they're implying this is healthy, and it's not healthy. So I figured, how do we defeat the industry and their ability to by this active marketing jiu-jitsu, take any critique and turn it into another way to sell us unhealthy food? And I realized, finally, we have to tune out the marketing. And the way you do that is you don't buy foods that are heavily promoted on television. And that gets most of them. And real food doesn't have the budget to be promoted on television. And my apologies to the prune growers and the walnut growers. There are a couple people, but I think people know enough not to confuse that with processed food.
A lot of people have been writing into our comment line. I'd like to read a few of them. Yukari left a comment. She said, my husband and I divide our time between Tokyo and New York City, and the first thing we notice when shopping in the supermarket is how cheap things like ice cream and chips are in the USA. In Japan, it's actually cheaper to buy fresh vegetables than to buy processed foods.
There you have it. That's agricultural policy right there. We are, you know, make no mistake, our government is subsidizing the cost of junk food.
Another listener says, isn't it important to note that the other cultures you mentioned are far more likely to be more active and work physically as opposed to many Americans who are bound to their desks and drive around in their cars?
I think that's absolutely right. And it's a mistake to remove the diet from the context of the lifestyle. And people on the Mediterranean diet, when we first studied that in the 50s, they were eating a lot less than we were, and they were doing a lot of physical labor. Look, the cane workers in Cuba get 6,000 calories of pure sugar, cane sugar, every day in their diet, and they're not fat and they're not diabetic because they're burning it off. That said, however, the obesity epidemic can be explained strictly by looking at food, not activity. There's no science showing that activity levels have really changed since 1980 when the obesity epidemic begins.
Another caller wants to know if these people who survive on sparse diets, like the Inuit who eat whale blubber, are doing it, becoming healthy because of what they're eating, or is there a genetic component?
There may be some genetic component, but in general, we have found that traditional diets do translate across countries. There have been studies of taking the Mediterranean diet, for instance, and giving it to Americans or British, and it works just as well, and they get the benefits from it. So I think the genetic component is not huge. On something like whale blubber, selected over many, many years, you know, there may be some genetic component. But and obviously on issues of lactose tolerance and gluten tolerance, all these kind of things do have a genetic component. But by and large, the wisdom of traditional diets is available to us, seal blubber notwithstanding.
Several of your rules mention the benefits of shopping at farmers markets. What's the benefit of buying local produce? And aren't we seeing more and more local produce in our supermarkets or many of our supermarkets around New York?
And it's a very healthy development. Local is a magic word now in food marketing, much the way organic was a couple of years ago. And that's a good thing. It supports local farmers.
But it usually at a premium price.
Yeah, it usually costs more. Not always, though. I've been at farmers markets around the country that can compete with supermarkets very well. It has to do with supply and demand, really. And look, the virtues of shopping at the farmers market are many, and they go way beyond health. I mean, there is the health benefit of eating food that's been picked at the peak of ripeness and gotten to you within 24 hours. We know that there is more nutritional value in that food. But there's also the social value. I mean, farmers markets have become the new public square. It's where we go to meet our friends. You know, we have 10 times more conversation at the farmers markets than we do in the supermarket, probably because we're not all following the same, you know, counterclockwise trail through them. We support farmers. We meet farmers. Country meets city. We preserve farmland. So it's not a strictly a health calculation for me. I go to the farmers market even when I don't need to buy groceries. Because I like the experience.
You mentioned shopping the periphery of the supermarket, something that Marion Nestle also promotes. That's because that's where all the good stuff is?
Well, as most supermarkets are constructed in a way that the most perishable food needs to be near the back and near the loading dock because they have to restock those shelves the most, whereas the stuff in the middle is immortal.
So you say you have another rule that says only eat foods that will eventually rot.
Yeah. Well, you know, think about it. What does rot mean? It means that these microorganisms and insects that we compete with for food have taken an undue interest in this stuff and gotten to it before we have. That's a good sign. They are still in touch with their instincts about what is actually nutritionally valuable. They leave the Twinkie alone. So, you know, food should rot, and we shouldn't feel bad about the fact that it does.
What happens when you find cheese in your refrigerator that has a lot of spots on it? Do you cut off the spots?
Or? I do. I will eat it. I will cut off the spots, and it's fine. And most of the molds that grow on cheese are absolutely fine to eat. You know, we have, as Americans—
I think of it as penicillin.
It is, probably. As Americans, we're really freaked out by the idea that food goes bad. And a lot of people buy processed food because they're afraid of just that. But we shouldn't be. And if you are, get a compost pile so you can feel better about throwing stuff out.
My guest is Michael Pollan. His latest book, Food Rules, an Eater's Manual, is published by Penguin. This is WNYC, wnyc.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Section 2 of your book is called Mostly Plants. Is there concrete evidence that a plant-based diet is healthier than a meat-based one?
Yeah, there is. There's epidemiological evidence. Vegetarians are healthier than carnivores as a rule.
But you are...
I'm a carnivore.
Carnivore.
But I'm what you would call a flexitarian. These are people who eat meat, but not every night. And, you know, the average American is eating 9 ounces of meat per person per day. It's way too much, both for the environment and for their health. We do know people who eat lots of red meat have higher rates of certain cancers and heart disease. But, you know, the most controversial words in that mantra of mine, eat food, not too much, mostly plants, is the word mostly, the adverb. And the reason is that we're such absolutists. We really feel it's got to be you're either a carnivore or you're a vegetarian. And that annoyed both camps because the carnivore said, you're dissing meat by saying mostly plants. And the vegetarian said, why not go all the way? And I don't think that's realistic.
Have you looked at 19th century menus?
I mean, this is before meat.
Yeah. In America. In fact, in England as well, maybe in France.
Yeah.
And by the way, this predates
high rates of heart disease, which strongly suggests that refined carbohydrates may be a more important culprit. Hmm. There are people who subsist on great amounts of meat. But the thing also to remember is it's not the same meat we're eating. And that 19th century steak was probably grass-fed and grass-finished, and so it didn't have as much saturated fat and had a lot of healthier fats. So one of my rules is eat meat from animals that have themselves eaten well. And we forget that our meat is not the same as their meat. And that goes for that seal blubber, too.
A Chinese person told me that he can always tell when a chef was trained in China or just came over from China, or whether they were American, by the amount of meat in a dish. Yeah. Meat in a dish in the traditional way is just one of the many flavorings.
Right.
In the American version, it's the predominant ingredient.
And I think that although the Chinese are moving, of course, to our approach to eating meat, which is really a shame, and they're getting a lot of chronic diseases as this has happened. But my suggestion for meat eating is treat it as a flavoring. This was Thomas Jefferson's suggestion, too. Treat meat as a flavor principle, not the center of your meal.
Rule 26 is drink the spinach water.
Yeah. Well, if you look at the spinach water or the broccoli water or whatever you've blanched or boiled vegetables in, you'll see it has a lot of color. And that color is good stuff. Antioxidants and other nutrients, phytochemicals, and we throw it down the drain. And
shouldn't we just cook them in a minimal amount of water in the microwave and avoid that problem?
Well, you could avoid that problem that way, but certain recipes require you to boil. And so I just try to make use of it. I put it in a soup, I put it in a sauce, and worst case, I pour it on my plants in the garden.
You also say that we should, we would benefit from extra freezer space.
Yeah,
Rule 28.
And this is tough in Manhattan, but one of the best investments I made was to buy a dedicated freezer, which are surprisingly inexpensive. They're just a couple $100. They use very little electricity because they don't get open that often. But that means when somebody is offering a good quarter of a grass-fed steer or half of a lamb, you can buy it, the whole thing, and put it in your freezer, and that's a way to eat really high-quality meat cheaply.
Although, then we get to the other side of that. Part 3 is called Not Too Much. And if we have
it's
a lot of food,
yeah,
and we have a lot of good food, we keep on eating.
Yeah, and, you know, Marion Nestle is so wise about this. She says so much of our conversation about nutrition is a way to avoid talking about calories. And it's the last thing we want to talk about. And that's why Not Too Much was an important thing to include in the book. And here, too, I looked at other cultures. And, you know, we're not the first people to have to navigate a landscape of food abundance. And other cultures have taboos and they have rules that help them. One that I kept coming across in every culture I examined was they have a rule for stopping eating before you're full.
How do you know that?
Well,
how do you know when that is?
You have to experiment. The first time, you may have to stuff yourself. And then you realize, you know, the Japanese say eat until you're 80% full. Prophet Muhammad said two-thirds full. And that's a radical concept for an American, to stop before you're full. But you can learn when that is. And one way to do it is the way the French do it. When they say they're full, they don't say they're full. They say, I have no more hunger. Je n'ai plus faim. And you think about that. When is your hunger gone? It's long before you're full. And if you can actually realize that's the goal, to remove hunger rather than to be full, that will be a revolution in your eating.
In fact, one of your rules is the banquet is in the first bite.
That was one from a listener, actually. And it's a beautiful rule because the food tastes best those first few bites. And you can keep eating, but you're not going to get as much pleasure as in those first few bites.
A few more listener questions. A caller wanted to know if frozen vegetables can be healthier than fresh vegetables.
Yes. Believe it or not, they can, because they're very often frozen right in the field and at the peak of their nutritional value. And sometimes, fresh produce has been on a truck from California for 5 days. I think frozen vegetables we overlook, actually, a lot of people in the food movement. And they're really important, they're really inexpensive, and it's a good way to get more produce in your diet cheaply.
Are you opposed to genetically engineered foods?
I try to avoid them when I can. They're not really in the produce section yet. They're really in the corn and the soy. And, there have been no proven health problems with genetically modified food. However, they contribute to a very sick kind of agriculture. They basically have allowed farmers to make monocultures bigger. So they're not making any contribution to improving our health. That may change in the future, but so far they haven't done that.
Antonio left this question on our show page. If you change your diet based on what you are outlining, how quickly will you see health benefits?
You'll lose 100 pounds.
You'll have a better love life.
You will. Everything will change for the better.
And you'll only listen to public radio from then on.
I think people who eat this way will feel better very soon. There's something about that junk food habit that puts us on this roller coaster of insulin and carbohydrate binging emotionally takes its toll. And I think that when people eat this way, there's a period of adjustment, getting used to a little less salt, that processed food flavor, and your threshold for salt and sugar has to change a little bit. And that might take a few weeks. But I think, I think people will feel better soon.
And home-cooked meals actually lend to a little more family getting together instead of watching TV while you're eating that's just come out of the microwave.
Eating together. Look, food is not just fuel. Food is communion, and we forget that. And we treat it, and this whole conversation about nutrition encourages us to treat it as a transaction between us and these chemicals, and it's not. It's about our social life. It's about our political life, too.
Just one more thing. A listener wonders, any tips on how to encourage kids to go for those healthy foods that don't have cartoons all over their packaging?
Yeah, well, don't bring that stuff in the house. I mean, that's the first thing. And don't take your kid shopping with you, because they'll throw that stuff in the cart whether you want it there or not. No soda in the house. Keep the sweetened cereals out of the house, too, or make it a Saturday thing.
Michael Pollan's latest book is Food Rules, an Eater's Manual. It is published by Penguin. And as always, it's been a great pleasure talking with you.
Well, thank you, Leonard. It is always a great pleasure.